and welcome to the Start Me Up podcast. It's April 3rd, and I'm Kimberly Johnson in Washington, D.C. My co-host Steph Walton is off today, but she says to say hello to everybody and that she'll be back next week. I'm excited today because it's the official launch of the weekly version of the Start Me Up podcast. So we're adding two free shows per month, and we're also going to be adding a women's roundtable with a different panel of guests each time, and we'll be discussing a variety of issues that concern women. I'm not sure when the first one will be this month, but there will be two this month, so stay tuned. And also I'm excited because today my guest is Tina Cassidy, and she's the author of the new book, Mr. President, How Long Must We Wait? Alice Paul, Woodrow Wilson, and the Fight for the Right to Vote. It's an eye-opening, inspiring, and timely account of the complex relationship between notable suffragist Alice Paul and President Woodrow Wilson in her fight for women's equality. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. But before we get going, I'd just like to remind everybody that Start Me Up is an independent podcast, and we're supported by listeners. So you can support the podcast by becoming a monthly subscriber for any dollar amount, whether it's $1 or $5, $10, $25. $5 gets you into And Another Thing, which is the segment we do after free shows. And FYI, today, that show will be free. And I'm going to be talking to writer Sarah Wood. We're going to be talking about toxic masculinity and what's considered appropriate and not appropriate behavior in the workplace. So be sure to tune into that one. It's going to be an interesting chat. But now, I would like to welcome my guest, Tina Cassidy, to the show. Hey, Tina.
Hi.
Thank you for coming on. I'm really excited to talk to you about your book because I, as you know, am an Equal Rights Amendment activist, and Alice Paul wrote the ERA. But before she did that, she wrote the amendment for women's suffrage, for women voting. So you wrote all about that.
Yes, I did. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Alice Paul is one of those figures from history who should be much better known than she is because mm-hmm. she's done so many things, including enfranchising half the population. And ultimately, she wrote two constitutional amendments, which is pretty remarkable for anybody.
Yes, indeed. And interestingly enough, before we get into this, the amendments are not very different in the way that they're worded. And so I think it's fascinating that sometimes critics of the Equal Rights Amendment are insistent on changing the wording, but nobody seems to be confused with the wording of the Voting Rights Amendment. So it's ridiculous to me. She was such an incredibly smart woman, and you wrote all about her. So let's just dig in. First mm-hmm. of all, I want to ask you, is this the first book you've ever written?
Nope, this is my fourth book.
Wow.
I generally write nonfiction about the intersection of women and culture. My first book was on the history of childbirth, and then I wrote a book about Jacqueline Onassis and her life in 1975. That's called Jackie After O. So that's really a book about the third act. And then this book, of course, also falls into that. So I'm definitely interested in history and women and, what can become a strong narrative at the intersection of all of that.
Wow. So what inspired you to write this book?
This book came about because in the summer of 2016, I was scrolling Twitter one morning while I was trying to work on a novel, and I came across a hashtag for Women's Equality Day. For those who don't know what that is, it marks the date in August when the 19th Amendment, which granted women the vote, was ratified. And I went down a whole Google rabbit hole to find out, how this amendment came to be, who were the forces involved. And I discovered just this incredible story that I had never heard before. And it's really a bummer that I had never heard it before. It mm-hmm. should be a story that every school child learns, definitely before graduating high school, let alone college. And this was just never part of any curriculum of mine.
And nor mine.
Yeah. Right. So I feel like this is a story that we all should know. I mean, as much as we know about Martin Luther King and the strides he made in the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. everyone needs to know who Alice Paul was and what the suffrage movement looked like, what it went through, how it evolved, and what we can learn from it today. That's ultimately what this book is about. For me, it was a way of understanding history so that I could apply it to our current situation.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about Alice Paul and what she was like and what inspired her to get involved and do what she did in this movement.
Yeah. So Alice Paul was a Quaker from New Jersey, and she was born in the late 1800s to a Quaker family who really brought her up believing that equality was essential. They believed everyone was created equal. As a child, she went to suffrage meetings with her mother, and she had a real belief in social justice. And so one of the things that she did after she graduated college was she moved to England to learn more about social justice there at a Quaker institution. And it was there that she saw the suffrage movement at sort of a critical point in that moment in time. This was when women were getting incredibly agitated and organized. And so Alice Paul joined them and learned everything she could from that movement, and then she brought it back to America.
Wow. So what was her superpower?
Her superpower was being single-minded. But as with most superpowers, that was also her fatal flaw, right?
Interesting,
and,
right.
Yes. So she was so single-minded about this idea that women deserve the vote and that everyone should be considered equal. She devoted her entire life to it. So we all owe her thanks for that.
Yes.
I think, even after she won the vote through the 19th Amendment in 1920, mm-hmm. 3 years later, she wrote the Equal Rights Amendment, which we are still debating today, and really just dedicated the rest of her life to equality. So, I mean, that's all amazing. She was a taskmaster. She was indefatigable. She knew how to raise money. She knew how to organize. All in the name of that very narrow goal of equality. I would say that one issue that Alice Paul had was that she never was able to. She was so focused on what it would take to win the vote that she was unable to really understand that for Black women they could not separate race from gender, mm-hmm. and said okay to her. To African Americans who were involved in the suffrage movement, we're going to win you the vote. But what she couldn't see is that Black women knew that they would be disenfranchised almost immediately due to racism. She just couldn't wrap her head around that. So I think, that single-mindedness was both a benefit and one of her challenges.
I have a question on what you're just talking about as far as Black women being... Are you saying Black women would be disenfranchised even with the 19th Amendment in place?
Yes, absolutely. So this is exactly what happened to Black men after the Civil War when there was a constitutional amendment that granted them the vote. What happened was many states, particularly in the South, imposed poll taxes and literacy tests to prevent them from voting.
Wow.
And Black women knew that the same thing would happen to them, and that is, in fact, exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And it's why in the 1960s we eventually got the Voting Rights Act to try to strip away some of those impositions on voting, especially for people of color. And, I mean, let's face it, there are still challenges with access to voting today.
Wow, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Curiously, I mean, when you wrote this book, obviously you did a lot of research, and I can only imagine that you saw as you were writing it some of the parallels in what's happening today. So
Absolutely.
Like that period in history and how it mimics today, what are some of those things that you think we have in common with that time?
Yeah. Well, there are a few very specific things and then some larger issues, maybe just starting with the specifics. First, Alice Paul organized the first Women's March. So this was in 1913.
Interesting.
She only had 2 months to pull it together. And it's shocking to think of what she was able to accomplish in such a short amount of time with basically no money in the days before email. Also, many people didn't even have telephones at that time. And she was able to get 8,000 people to march down Pennsylvania Avenue toward the White House to impress on the incoming president, Woodrow Wilson, that women wanted the vote. And it was nothing like this had ever happened before. Women had never organized in a protest of this scale or in this location. And so it was epic and had a real impact on setting the tone for Wilson's presidency, even though he was staunchly against granting women the vote. And she knew that, and that's why she organized this in the way she did. It was a catalytic moment for women getting organized. So that's one example of how it parallels today. The second issue is that Woodrow Wilson, as a presidential figure, was in office at an important time in American history. This was the start of what we now today call the progressive movement. It was a time when the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was organized, when unions were becoming organized, the AFL-CIO emerges from this period. And yet he was in the White House as a progressive Democrat saying, I'm putting a stop to basically progress on social issues. So not only was he against women's suffrage, but he one of the first things he did in office was he segregated the civil service. That meant, Black people who worked at the post office had to work behind screens so that the public didn't see them. Black and white employees could not eat lunch at the same table anymore. It meant that Black patrons had to go to a different window to get government services. It meant that Black people who were applying for government jobs had to submit a photograph so that decisions could be made based on race. So it was incredibly harmful to our democracy and to our culture. So there's Woodrow Wilson. The other thing that's happening is that World War I breaks out, and Wilson is struggling with what America's role should be during the war. And one thing he was not going to have was any dissent. So he was highly critical of the press, and basically was highly critical of anyone who would be protesting against him. So there became sort of a mob mentality out there. There were vigilante teams. So anyone who was not in the war, walking down the street, they would just round people up and say, you know, you must be a spy because you're not overseas fighting.
Wow.
And then the third thing, this is just kind of hilarious, is that there was a big brouhaha with Russia. right? Of course there was. And Alice Paul exploited this to her benefit. So there was some Russian envoys who came to the U.S. to talk to Wilson about the war. And at that time, Russia allowed its women to vote. And Alice Paul saw this opening of, well, here we are in America fighting for democracy abroad, and yet you're not even letting American women vote. And so they protested while the Russian delegation was arriving, and it created just sort of an international firestorm and made Woodrow Wilson incredibly angry. And then he started arresting the protesters.
Wow. And then, yeah, there were suffragists who were standing outside of the White House holding signs wanting him to listen to them, and they got arrested. And this is the part of the story that, of course, for me, because I've always liked the most sensational part of any story. And to me, the most sensational part was that the fact that these women, Alice Paul and all the women that worked with her, were willing to go to jail for this. And not only were they willing to go to jail, they went on hunger strikes. Right. And I mean, you know, your book did a fantastic job of describing the prison conditions, which were just abysmal. I mean, that, you know, reading that there were open toilets that could only be flushed from the outside.
Imagine.
And the food that they had to eat. You gave great detail on what it was like in prison and what it was like for the women. And the fact that they were force feeding these women raw eggs and milk. Yes. And Alice Paul had, what kind of stomach problem did Alice Paul have?
Well, people believe that she was actually damaged in England when she was arrested and organizing with the Pankhurst women, who were the leaders of the British suffrage movement, that when she was in prison and on a hunger strike and force-fed there, that they did damage to her system, like with the tube up her nose and so forth, and that people think she didn't have a proper sense of smell and didn't have a proper appetite, and that she had all kinds of digestive issues from there on out.
Yeah, and it's awful and disgusting to read, because I mean she was vomiting this right back up on the doctors, and it sounds awful, but I mean this woman, it just blows my mind that these women were so determined.
Put their lives on the line.
Yeah, for me.
Yeah.
So that for me and for you and for everybody else, and it makes me so upset to know that people just don't vote. They just don't even think about it, and they don't care. And frankly, you know, I actually wrote a book where I talked about Alice Paul called American Woman, the Pole Dance Woman in Voting. My book was a little bit more casual than yours. I didn't only write about that. I wrote about, in my opinion, the importance of voting and then also just feminist issues. And I did talk about Alice Paul. And the reason that I wrote that book is I wanted to write it for women who were like me, who were, you know, in their 20s and didn't think about voting. My first vote did go to Bill Clinton, and I was in my 20s. But prior to that, I had never voted, and I just didn't care. You know, and then it just became an incremental, as I got older, I got more and more interested in politics. But it was very difficult, you know, I mean, in my, when you're young, you're focused on things like, you know, dating and working and school and whatever it is that's, you know, on your mind. And so the last thing that you're thinking about is voting, because you're thinking, oh, politicians are just a bunch of corrupt jerks and they don't really care about me and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I mean, that's, I wanted to write the book because I wanted women who didn't really care to start caring. But obviously, I think the idea is, you know, you get older, and there are a lot of young people today that are definitely paying attention. There's several reasons. You know, Trump is one of them. Mm-hmm. But I think, go ahead.
Women are definitely paying attention. I think one interesting trend line that has occurred since, well, the very first election after women won the vote in 1920, there was low turnout for women just because they needed to be educated. They didn't, you know, lots of them, maybe their husbands wouldn't let them vote. I mean, there were so many reasons why that first election was not a great success. But by the next election, women were voting at the same levels of men. And really, since then, women outvote men.
Yeah.
So the women's vote is absolutely essential our democracy. And we're affected by our democracy. And, you know, to think about what it might mean if we didn't have the vote, I mean, you really don't, you know, it was our grandmother's generation. It's not that long ago. And there are still people today who are impacted by lack of access to the ballot box for whatever reason. And I think we just all need to be much more conscious about how fundamental voting is to our democracy and encourage everybody to get out and vote, regardless of what their political beliefs are.
I totally agree. Absolutely. I think that if more women were paying attention and more women voted, we'd have a completely different political landscape. You know, and like what you're saying, it doesn't matter their ideology. I think we would just have a different political landscape.
Yeah. And now more women are running for office, which is even better.
Yes, thankfully, and hopefully even more. And I'm really hoping that we have a woman president next time around.
It's about time.
It is about time. And what about this? When I was reading your book, I was wondering, if there were any surprises for you when you were writing this.
I think that the big surprise is a macro impression, which is just the length of time it took to make this change happen. So, I mean, Alice Paul was at it for, you know, 10 years until the 19th Amendment passed. But if you think about, you know, women trying to vote in America, it goes back even before Seneca Falls in the 1860s. So 75 years had passed before, you know, that event happened and women won the vote. You know, it's almost a century. And think about, you know, to the point that you just mentioned, you know, okay, and we still haven't had a woman president. Well, how many more years do we have to wait for that? So I think the pace of change and just really confronting that was helpful to me because we're so impatient now. And I'm not saying we should be more patient. Impatience is great. It helps push change forth. This was what Alice Paul said. Enough is enough. 75 years is enough. You know, we've waited long enough. We deserve it. We're equal to men. And it just, you know, it's really important context, though. So, you know, if there's a four-year presidential cycle that seems like forever, well, it's a long time, but it's actually not forever. I think we have to always try to keep in mind what is the big picture? What is that incremental change we can make today so we don't feel so defeated about, you know, the long-term vision?
Well, then That leads me to the question about the Equal Rights Amendment. It
Yeah.
was written in 1923, correct?
Correct.
So we're at 2019. This
Yes,
is
yeah.
coming up on 100 years.
That's right.
And we are making incremental changes. In fact, there was a deadline that was put on, well, there was an extension and that extension died. So back in the, what, like 80s, I think it was put on in the 70s, and then I think it was like 82 or 83 when
That's
that
right.
deadline expired. And so since that time, they ha prior to that, they had ratified 35 states, and we need 38. So since the deadline expired, we have ratified two more states. We got Nevada in 2017 and Illinois in 2018. Now we just need one more state. So there have been some increments since that time, since 1980s, early 80s. I know that people, ERA activists, have been at it and really haven't gotten anywhere. I mean, I had a small role in 2013 when I was working with a group of women in Virginia, and they were trying, well, it was a variety of women, but specifically this group of women in Virginia who were trying to get the Democratic senators involved and even the representatives just to sign on to a resolution to remove the deadline. It wasn't a vote, but it was just a support of that resolution. And without going into too much detail, it was like pulling teeth. And these were
Yeah.
Democrats that we were dealing with. Eventually they came around, but it was only after I had to, I strong-armed them with an unflattering blog post. And, I was more than willing to play the bad guy in this particular situation. And unfortunately, at that time, that's what it took to get them to sign on to that resolution. So I guess my question to you on this, as far as incremental progress, what do you think, I mean, as far as the ERA and getting that last state needed, do you have any ideas on A, which state that might be, or what I guess paths we could take to get the last state ratified?
Great questions. I think that the conventional wisdom inside the movement is that Virginia could actually be the last state. It seems as if there was enough votes in the House in the previous legislative session to get it done, but the House Speaker would not let it come up for a vote, and that is after the state Senate had approved it. So Virginia is so close. So I think that that's a real hopeful opportunity. I think there's some people who believe North Carolina could be the 38th state. They've had a lot of political drama there over the last year, and the ERA has not risen to the top of the list in terms of priorities. I think you have to look at the purple states, and that's where that 38th state is going to be. But I don't think people were necessarily anticipating that Illinois or Nevada would pop up in the way that they did, right? So I think we're in a new moment, and we just have to be alert. And I think there's just a great opportunity to make something happen because there is forward momentum on the ERA, and we have more women running for office and so much else. And I think the youth vote is also important, although I would say the biggest challenge with the ERA is that most people already think it has passed. It did pass Congress, but it has not been ratified, so it is not part of our Constitution. Women, the word women doesn't even show up in our Constitution. And so, I think it's about educating people, and the more people learn that the ERA doesn't exist, I think the more they're going to be outraged, and the more they're going to call on their leaders at the state level to say, "Hey, let's do it. Why not be the heroes here after a century, right?"
Exactly. I mean, I met a woman named Camila Lopez who made a movie named Equal Means Equal. I met her
Right.
in 2012, and she's the one who told me. She asked me if I thought women were equal in the United States. I said yes. She explained that I was wrong, and from that moment, I became an ERA activist. I'm certainly no expert, but I'm pretty well versed in what is and isn't available to women at this point because we don't have the ERA. But one thing I'd like to say is that, whenever we talk about this online, and we see specifically men, but it could be women too, who for some reason get so upset when this is mentioned, and they insist that equal rights already exist, and they say, men will say, "Well, what rights do I have that you don't?" And I like to kind of say, it's Yes, women have rights. It's not saying that we don't have rights. It's that nobody in the Constitution is protected against gender discrimination. So if you're at a workplace situation and you're being discriminated against because you're a male or a female, there is nothing in the Constitution that's going to protect you if this is brought to a court of law. And then the book Equal Means Equal by Jessica Neuwirth has many different cases that, you know, there was one, I think, in an insurance company was paying a woman less than her male counterparts, and nobody could cite in the Constitution anything that would help her. So, of course, she lost that court case. So it goes down to there's violence against women, there's pregnancy discrimination, there's, and then the other thing is there's a loophole, and people don't know this because a lot of critics also like to point out the Equal Pay Act. Oh, well, we have the Equal Pay Act, so we don't need the ERA. First of all, there is a loophole in the Equal Pay Act, and this was in Jessica Neuwirth's book, Equal Means Equal, that if you were a victim of discrimination in the past, an employer can base your salary on what you were paid before. So let me go back. If you were a woman or a man, but mainly a woman, and you got less than your male counterparts in past positions, your current employer can base your salary on what you were paid before. So yeah. That is the loophole, meaning that the discrimination can carry on legally. So right. ERA would close that loophole. And people also don't understand that, you know, state laws and even federal laws can be repealed. And it's much more difficult to get rid of an amendment. So
absolutely.
This doesn't hurt anyone.
It doesn't hurt anyone. And in fact, most people don't know what the ERA says. It basically says you cannot discriminate based on sex. That's it.
Yep,
and that
period.
Applies to men. That applies to men too. That applies to anybody. And so I think, you know, that's important to keep in mind. It is a one sentence amendment. It is so simple and clear. You know, I think people also just don't, even women, young women today don't even know that their mothers or their grandmothers probably couldn't even take out a bank loan without a man signing for them. That's just horrifying.
Yeah, they couldn't get credit cards. Right.
Right. And so, you know, there is a patchwork of state laws across the country that would just be monumental to try to change and to delete just centuries of sexism and gender bias, you know, where one constitutional amendment can fix it. So I think that's what we all need to work toward.
Oh, I totally agree. So before we end up, I'd like to ask you one more question. What are some of the key takeaways from your book?
The key takeaways for me are, you know, never give up, that protest works, and that in order for democracy to be successful, it needs to include everyone. And if you're not, you know, fighting to lift all boats, you know, it's really not a democratic effort.
Yes. Amen. I mean, I'm so glad you wrote this book. And in fact, I think every high school and every college should make every student read this book, because as you mentioned earlier, you didn't learn about this. This was not in your curriculum, and it wasn't in mine. And I know that I would have paid attention to this because I had a great history teacher in high school, and I had him for a couple of years in a row, and he was so fun because he just loved history so much. And I remember one specific occasion when he was talking about Diamond Jim Brady, and he sat in front of the class and he was just so animated and had so much fun telling us about it. And the bell rang and it was lunch and nobody wanted to leave because he wasn't finished yet. And so I know that if he would have talked to us about Alice Paul, I was always a feminist. And always had a big mouth and always had strong opinions about women. So I would have loved to learn about this. I've learned about it now, and everybody listening should get a copy of this book. I'm going to say the name one more time. It's Mr. President, How Long Must We Wait? Alice Paul, Woodrow Wilson, and the Fight for the Right to Vote. Why don't you tell us where they can get it?
It is available at your local bookstore or on Amazon, and you can also check it out on my website, tinacassidy.info.
All righty. And then where can they find you on Twitter? What's your handle?
At tinacassidy2, that's the numeral 2, and I also tweet at History of Birth. That's another subject.
Perfect.
It's all focused on childbirth. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kimberly. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the writing of this really important book and for coming on the show. And don't forget, everyone, I'll be chatting with writer Sarah Wood at the end, Another Thing segment. And that's going to be free today. So be sure to tune in. And thanks again, Tina. Take care.
Thank you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.